The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Christopher Brown. I'm a children's librarian at the Wadsworth branch of the Free Library, and it's my great honor to introduce to all of you two-time Caldecott winner, Chris Van Elsberg.
thank you. I was actually here 8 or 9 years ago. Is that right? About then? Yeah. None of you were here at that time, though, were you? Because I hate repeating the same stories or feeling like I'm wearing out my material. So anyway, over the years when I've gone out to talk about my work, I've found that what people are mostly curious about are the same sort of central questions. And those questions I've sort of boiled down to actually three. And so I'm going to answer some of those, or at least talk a little bit about those questions that I've heard so many times. And then with the time left, I'm going to ask you if you have any that I didn't cover. So anyway, any guesses on what the most frequently asked question is? Where do you get your ideas? Yeah, now I was going to do that number two. Number one is, How did you end up doing this? How come you're writing and illustrating books? And that's kind of a sort of an interesting story. I think of myself as an accidental author and an accidental illustrator because I didn't grow up with a dream of doing this. I didn't, as a youngster, sit down with my crayons and a paper and write my little stories and draw pictures. It wasn't something that was particularly interesting to me. And I actually got into art school almost by accident. And the way that happened was I had the benefit of meeting with an admissions officer for the college that I went to, which was the University of Michigan. I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And an admissions person came to my high school, and I had a meeting with him, and this person was actually empowered to admit me to the University of Michigan just by looking at my transcript, having a conversation with me, confirming that I was a wonderful person. And that's the way it worked. Very low stress compared to what happens today. So I went to this meeting with the admissions person. And we talked for a little bit, and he said, "Well, Chris, what are you interested in? What do you want to study when you get to the University of Michigan?" And I hadn't given it much thought, and I looked at the little brochure I had in front of me, and there was a school within the university called the College of A&D, and I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, that's architecture and design. That's the art school." And for some reason, in the 3 or 4 seconds that passed between him saying that and me answering, I had images of my childhood when I would play with clay and play with finger paint, and I thought, well, gee, that would be a great way to go to college. Just playing around. So I said to the admissions person, "That sounds good. I think I'd like to study art." And so he looked at my transcript, my high school transcript, and there was no art on there because I wasn't interested in art. Didn't think of myself as particularly gifted in it. And he pointed this out. He said, "Chris, I'm sorry, you don't have any art in your transcript." And I felt challenged by him. I answered the challenge by telling him the following story. I said that, of course, it's not because my own artistic skill level had gone beyond the point where I could get anything of any benefit in my high school art classes. I studied privately on weekends and had set up a little sculpture studio on my front porch. And that was how I was educating myself. I was a self-educated artist. along with some of these lessons outside of school. So he was impressed by that, and then asked me a very important question. He asked me what I thought of Norman Rockwell, and I think he was trying to measure my sophistication. At least I thought he might have been. And I wasn't sure how to answer this particular question, because I thought, if he was trying to measure my sophistication and I expressed my admiration for Norman Rockwell, he might think less of me. But on the other hand, if he really loved Norman Rockwell and I thought I would share with him my low opinion of Norman Rockwell, which I didn't have, then he would also think poorly of me. So I had to try to figure out, before I answered, what was the correct answer. And so I sized him up. He was an admissions person, worked in the Midwest, wore white socks, had a pocket protector, and I made the, I think, pretty obvious guess that he liked Norman Rockwell a lot. And I said, you know what? Norman Rockwell is a genius. He's able, in a single picture, to tell a story which has so filled with emotion, so filled with feeling. It arouses sentiment in people that they were unaware they had, and I think he's a great American artist. And he goes, "You are right, son." And that marked my entry into the University of Michigan Art School. So I got there, and it turned out that I was in the company of a lot of young people who actually did study privately on weekends and were really, really good. And when I saw the way they could draw, I thought that they had a gift that they were born with. I didn't really appreciate that they had learned how to draw that well. And so I felt intimidated, wondered if I'd really made a bad decision. But then I took a course in three-dimensional design, which is sort of introduction to sculpture. And I found that I was good at that. And it was partly because there was something I did when I was young that I was good at and was very interested in, and that was building models. I built model cars, model boats, model planes, and I was a fastidious craftsman, really to the point where if you saw one of my models, you would probably be concerned about the child who built them because they were just too good. So anyway, interacting with the materials that I ran into in three-dimensional design, I rediscovered this ability that I had for working with materials, making things, and also being kind of a nitpicky little craftsman. So I started making sculpture, and I found refuge in sculpture because I was no longer called upon to study the fundamentals of picture making. I didn't have to draw anything anymore except the things I was going to build. So most of my drawing experience all through college, and this would include graduate school, I was drawing pictures of the things I was going to make. So I was drawing from my imagination because the things didn't exist yet. But that was my background as a draftsperson, as a drawer. I wasn't making pictures, drawing pictures of objects, and I didn't learn how to use watercolor. I didn't learn how to use oil paint. I didn't learn how to use anything. All I knew how to use was a pencil. So I graduated from the University of Michigan. I went on to graduate school at the Rhode Island School of Design and set up a little studio in Providence, Rhode Island to make sculpture, and it was going pretty well. Actually had a gallery representing me down in New York City. But I moved into a studio that was owned by a landlord who turned the heat off at around 5 o'clock in the afternoon during the winter. And the studio became bitterly cold, and my habit as a passionate young artist was to work late into the night, but I couldn't any longer because it was just too darn cold. So I needed a hobby. So I figured, why not start drawing? I knew how to draw a little bit because I drew the pictures of the things I built, but I thought this time I would draw pictures. So I started drawing pictures. And the pictures appeared to be from stories, but the stories didn't exist. I remember one of the first pictures I drew was simply a man who was standing at a table surrounded by dinner guests, all dressed formally. It looked like it may have been a room in the 1930s or 40s. It was a pencil drawing, black and white. And there was a man who was biting into a plate, and there were little plate shards on his tuxedo. And I just called it the Impatient Dinner Guest. And I did a lot of, well, not a lot. I did maybe like a dozen drawings like that. And then a friend of mine who was actually an illustrator said, you know, Chris, I think these pictures look a lot like illustrations. His name was David McCauley. And he was publishing at the time, had a relationship with Houghton Mifflin. And he said, why don't you go up and see my publisher, my editor? So I was too shy and embarrassed, but my wife took my portfolio of these drawings, which were not for a book. They were just black and white pencil drawings. And she took the portfolio up there, and the editor up there, his name's Walter Lorraine. Walter said, I kind of like this stuff. I think this could work. Why doesn't Chris come up and see me? And my wife said, well, he's not really fully committed to this idea of maybe making picture books. And he said, well, here's what I'll do. I'm going to give you some manuscripts. Take them down and show them to Chris. And then we can talk about it. Maybe he'd be interested in illustrating some of these manuscripts. So I got the manuscripts, and they were stories about, you know, little Bunny's first day at school, where he would get on the school bus, and he'd be worried if he had enough carrots and things like that. And they were sweet stories, but they weren't stories that inspired me as a picture maker. So I ignored them, and I went back into my sculpture studio and just kept on making sculpture. And I think about 6 or 7 months passed, and Walter Lorraine, still interested in the unusual pencil drawings he'd seen, called and said to me, so what's up? You don't want to do this? And I said, well, I don't think so, because I just can't draw bunnies, you know, climbing onto a school bus. I think I could now, but back then, I just couldn't see a way to do it that would make me proud of myself. So he said, well, here's the solution, Chris. If as a picture maker, you are determined to have some control over the content, the subject matter, then you have to write your own stories. And I said, but I've never written anything before. And he said, well, why don't you give it a shot? So that's how I became a writer, challenged by an editor who had only seen a handful of my drawings to prove that I could actually write, well, not to prove it, but just to maybe make the effort and see if the result gave me the opportunity I was looking for, which was, as an illustrator, to have some control over the subject matter, the thing I was going to draw. So this is the first book, and now I can get on to question number two, which is where ideas come from. So when Walter said, why don't you write your own story, I'd been drawing pictures of topiary gardens, gardens that are like this. They have large bushes that are shaped in fanciful arrangements and object shapes, animals in this case. And so I said, gosh, I'd love to just do a whole bunch of topiary garden pictures. I could do that. That would be fun. So I started working on the story that all took place inside a topiary garden, but it was not getting me anywhere. And so I said, I went back to this one image that I had in my imagination, which was a boy chasing a dog through a topiary garden. So as a first-time storyteller, I thought, well, maybe there's a story there, I just haven't found it yet. So I started asking myself some simple questions. Well, who's the dog? Who's the boy? Why is the boy chasing the dog? And even maybe more, I don't know, greater potential is, who owns that garden? Who owns that very strange garden? So I started just basically answering the questions that I asked myself, and I discovered by answering those that the boy was given care of the dog for the day. The dog was disobedient. Boy had to chase the dog when the dog got away, and the dog ran into this garden, which is the garden of Abdul Ghazizi. And so that's where I'd sort of gotten myself to, and I said, okay, so there's a big scary guy, it's his garden, he doesn't like dogs. So what else is going to happen? And then I decided, well, he's a retired magician. And so as I kept along, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the book, but there's a there's an event which happens, which the boy doesn't really fully understand. He doesn't know that if his dog, actually a dog he's been taking care of, if it's been turned into a duck, or if the magician has simply done a sleight of hand and switched his duck for a dog and made him believe that the duck that he's chasing is his dog. But it may not be. But anyway, that was the story that I discovered. I didn't have in my mind at the beginning, oh, I'll write a story that tries to compare sleight of hand magic to genuine Merlin the Magician kind of magic. And yet, that's where I was led by my efforts to find some story at all. So I finished this story, and I sent it up to Walter Lorraine. He said, well, it's black and white, so that's a little bit different, and the ending is unresolved. We don't really know what happened. And I said, well, I don't know. That's where I think it's got to end. And much to his credit, he said, you know what? I agree. So printed this black and white book. It's got a story that doesn't really have an ending. And I thought, well, that's it for me. I did my one book. Now I can go back and make some sculpture. And much to my surprise, the book received this distinction. They call the Caldecott Honor Medal. And so that's where that idea came from. Now, I've got a bunch of books in here. And I'm willing to describe the idea process for all of them. Can't do that because there's not enough time. Also, there's a demystification of the process there, because I think if I describe the creative process too simply and too logically, it'll be demystified for you, and you think, oh, gosh, that's no big deal. I could have done that. But anyway. So this is the next book I did. And because, there was one thing about this. I remember reading a review that said, Van Allsburg has, with such incredible insight, taken this unusual story and decided to do it in black and white. That he could have done it in color or other materials and chosen black and white was such an insight, such a correct choice. And I thought, well, that's great, because that's the only thing I could have done it in. And that was true for the second book, too, except that now I was actually getting pretty good with the pencil. And I was using it in different ways. This is a slightly different kind of pencil. And I decided that I needed more information when I drew, which means I started using models. In the case of rhinoceros like this, I would go to a toy store and get little plastic rhinoceros so I could sort of figure out what the how the light would fall on them. And so the inspiration for this Jumanji, it's a story about a game board, which comes to life. And the beginning of this was a little bit like the Garden of Abdul Ghazezi. It was visual. I knew as an artist that putting things together in a single picture that don't ordinarily are not ordinarily juxtaposed was a provocative and exciting way to make a picture. It's called cognitive dissonance. Those things don't go together. So I had this idea, nice, peaceful home where we associate security, quiet, and then I was going to put some jungle animals in it. So that's just a visual premise. That's not a story either, no more than a boy standing in a topiary garden. So I started to think, well, how did the jungle animals, how do they get into the house? Where are they from? And there's some easy answers, like, you know, they escaped from the zoo or something like that. And for some reason, about the same time I was thinking about this, I was thinking about the keen disappointment playing board games has, because when you're young and you're playing Monopoly, and you know, you actually bankrupt your parents, and it's such a great feeling while it happens, but it's just so transitory and doesn't really have the real potent feeling of, you know, throwing them out of Park Place or whatever. I thought, well, that's where the animals came from. They came from playing a game board, and this particular game is for children who don't have imagination. Because they don't have imagination, the game actually says, okay, jungle stampede, you can't imagine that? You don't need to. Here it comes. So that was the idea behind Jumanji. Ben's Dream, the story about a flood, and the story here was sort of inspired by a notion I've had, which is that there's the psychological kind of thing that happens when we're dreaming and the real life things that we combine with it to create a single narrative. And in this case, it's about a young boy who's studying the great landmarks of the world, but he's falling asleep while there's an incredible rainstorm outside. So those two elements are combined. He's reading about Mount Rushmore, but he's listening to the rain, and he's in the REM sleep phase, and they get combined to create a single story, which is deep water. Yeah, so here he is going past the Sphinx. Now, while I was writing it, I discovered another story theme that I could introduce. Before he goes to sleep, he parts company with a young friend who's also studying the great landmarks of the world. She goes to sleep. They meet at the end of the book after the rain has stopped because they had planned to play baseball together. And the boy describes a strange dream he had. He said, "I had this dream and I went around all these, I went past the Eiffel Tower, then the Sphinx." And he says, "You'll never guess who I saw when I went past the Sphinx." And she said, "Me waving from my house." And he's amazed. Well, how could she know his dream? And she said, "Well, because I had the same dream. I saw you there too." So I thought this was an interesting idea, that if two people had the same dream, they could actually meet each other there. Once again, a story idea that was discovered. I didn't sit down to write a story about that. I discovered it in the process of writing. Wreck of the Zephyr. Another story that was driven principally by a visual image. I actually drew this as a cover for Cricket magazine. And it was a standalone image. It didn't have a story that went with it. But when I was done with it, I was curious, in the same way I was about the boy chasing the dog. What are those boats doing up in the air? How do they do that? The Mysteries of Harris Burdick. This one I'm always reluctant because I've been credited for such a terrific act of invention and creativity here that if I reveal how easy it was, people will say, well. but anyway, I used to go to flea markets, and one of the stalls at the flea market that I went to was a fellow who sold ephemera, which are things made from paper. And one of the categories of objects that he sold were little illustrations from books. Often old illustrated books have greater value if you strip the illustrations out, put a little mat on them, than the book intact would have. So this fellow would find an old book that had illustrations in it, he would cut out the illustrations, mat them, throw the book away, and then he would have maybe 15 or 20 illustrations, and they would have little captions on them. And so I remember pawing through his little basket of illustrations once, and it occurred to me, well, the picture isn't really not that striking, it's not that provocative, but when I looked at the picture and I saw the caption, like a man leaning up against a door with his head in his hands, you know, it was just a fellow, maybe tired, maybe sad, grief-stricken, I don't know. But then there would be a little caption, and it'd say, like, he'd wished he could go back again, but he knew he never would, you know. And I said, well, you know, the caption by itself, okay, the picture by itself, okay, but the two together are gangbusters, you know. So then all I needed was a premise for me to be able to present this as something even more mysterious than just stumbling across it in a flea market. So thus we have Harris Burdick. How are we doing on time? When is Chris? Oh, I'm fine? I'm going fast? Okay. So here, a Christmas story, and people always interested in the genesis of this story, and the only way I can describe the process of having written this is that it was just me revisiting the sad feelings when I heard someone suggest that maybe there was no such thing as Santa Claus, and it made me feel so bad for a little while until a year later when the Polar Express pulled up to my house, that I thought I would revisit that experience, how terrible it feels like that can't be true, and then to have had my faith restored just 1 year later by riding on this fabulous train. So I decided I would just write that story out, and it really was just writing out a memory. I didn't. Sometimes when you write a story, you have to make little inroads. It goes in one direction, and you have to go back and reverse and try another direction. This, because I remembered this story, because this came to me almost literally as a memory, one draft straight through. All done, and of course that's because all I had to do was remember it. The stranger. This was just an idea I had about putting myself in the place of someone who's mythic. I suppose it may have had a little bit to do because, as a boy, of course, I met Santa Claus. So I was interested in the inner life of the mythic character. I'd actually read, I can't remember who, I read a piece, in, it was in Atlantic, someone who'd written about Medusa and had also wondered about the thoughts of the individual snakes on Medusa's head. And I thought, well, that's an interesting kind of tactic to try to get into the mythic character. So this mythic character, who's never identified in the course of the book, he's only the stranger, is someone who's actually pretty well known in the northern climates, and who forgets who he is. And because he forgets who he is, the climate freezes. It cannot change. It's always autumn, or I should say always just before autumn. Where he is. Some of you have probably read this and figured it out, so a spoiler alert, this guy is Jack Frost. But because he's forgotten who he is, because of an accident, he cannot carry out his seasonal duties, which include bringing the frost, killing off these plants, turning the leaves from green to gold, which is what he's just discovered here. So when he realizes that, even though he's found great comfort in living with the family that he's been with, he realizes he has a duty, and duty calls. So he gets back on the road or back in the field, and he has to carry out his chores. So the Z was apt. Even though I did. When I did Jumanji, attempt to start using models more frequently, it's still the fact that you have to make up a lot of things when you are sort of working on fantasies, working on, you know, certain subject matter. So I had this desire to draw something that I could actually see, just like an old-fashioned painter paints a still life. That vase is in front of him. He doesn't have to imagine where the highlight on the vase is. He has it to look at. So I wanted to do a book where I could just draw what I saw. So this is not the best example because I did not see the lightning. But I did see everything else. I built a little stage. I built all the letters. And then, in the case of this one, I would put it on little bits of wire so it stood up so I knew where the shadows fell. But yes, I did make up the lightning. Made nothing up here, even given the subject matter of my latest book, feel guilty revealing this, except I actually went and got a goldfish too, because I set up a rule for myself. I didn't want to make anything up. I knew the lightning I'd have to do, but I said, I'm not going to make up a goldfish. I got a pet store down the street. So this is the D is drowning. I took the D apart because it wouldn't fit into the aquarium, put it back together, filled it up with water, and then put the little goldfish in there and drew it. And I made a deal. This is why I want to defend myself, because of my last book. I made a deal that if I brought the fish back in a day, everything would be okay. So I did. I drew the fish in a day, got it back to the pet shop, and he was re-released into the giant aquarium. But it lives on in my book. This is an easy sort of thing to talk about where ideas come from. People say, gosh, how do you get these? Where do they come from? I mean, how do you keep doing that? Sometimes it's just a matter of looking around. I woke up one morning, there were two ants on my countertop, and I thought, well, I'm looking at them now. But if I didn't see them and I just went about making my breakfast and they got mixed up with that, it could be really bad for them. It's kind of bad for them anyway, because I removed them from the countertop. But it started me thinking, well, that's an enormous journey for the ants to make. I imagined that they lived in my backyard, that they'd gone across the backyard, which for them, which would be like traveling through a jungle. And then if they climbed up the wall to my kitchen, that would be like climbing Everest for them, and then climbing through a little hole in my window. And so it was all about the ants' view of this incredible journey, which was to get to the sugar bowl in my house. Yes, there they are, on their way through the jungle, which is just the backyard. So this book is probably really unusual amongst all the books I've done, because, as I said, most of these stories that I've written, I don't know where they're going when I start them out, and I don't pretend that they have a theme or a message. They almost always end up having a message, but it's not because I've intended that they have one at the beginning. They just kind of reveal themselves while I write. But this one is, you could call, polemical. It's it really is about the environment and what's happening and different kinds of futures that might await mankind. And I tried to make it not scary. I borrowed something thematically from a fabulous illustrator named Winsor McKay, who had little Nemo who would travel around in his bed on occasion. So this is a story about a boy who visits the future in his bed, and it's a future that he imagined at the beginning of the story would be filled with technological marvels, but is filled with a lot of bad news, like this. All right, so I have to maybe amend slightly what I just said. This story is also slightly polemical, but it's also kind of allegorical, I guess. This is called The Wretched Stone, and it's about a stone some sailors discover, and it ends up having a very negative effect on them. Written many years ago, the negative effect on them is it turns them into primates as a result of spending too much time around it, and it's always interpreted as being television, but I basically saw it as the glowing screen. So it makes it actually pretty apt even for a modern audience. So the whole crew turns into primates, unable to help the captain sail the ship. But the captain finds that once the rock has gone dead, which is the result of the storm, he is able to bring the primates back to their human shape. I should say they're lower primates, back to their higher primate state, by reading to them and playing the violin, because these are the civilizing forces that counteract the terrible effects of the wretched stone. Yeah. 5 minutes? Okay, well, why don't... Oh, here's what I'll do. Let's zip through. Oh. 5 minutes to the end or 5 minutes for questions? Oh, okay, great. All right, so this is another one that's so easy to describe, and so, you know, when I tell you how I came about doing this, you'll go, gee, why did somebody do that before? So I was in my three-year-old's bedroom, and she had a bunch of coloring books, and one of them was a Walt Disney Peter Pan coloring book, and Princess Tiger Lily was in a pool of water, and she was drowning. She didn't know how to swim. And Peter was off in the distance flying toward her to rescue her. And she had this terribly alarmed expression on her face because she was going down. She was going to drown. And it was, you know, really frightening. And I looked at it, and my daughter had covered her face with purple and green and black crayons. And I had the impression when I looked at it that the reason Tiger Lily was doing that was because of what my daughter had done to her. She was doing this because those crayon marks were so awful. So I wondered, well, what would it be like to be a character in a coloring book but not know that that was actually where you lived, and then to have it fall into the possession of a boy who was not very good at staying in between the lines. And so this is the story of those characters. This is the sheriff, who's actually sort of the hero of the story. And there's a point in the story where the stagecoach comes into town, but the coach driver is not there, so he has to go out and find the coach driver. And this is what he finds, this terrible, terrible scene of the coach driver. So, Zathura, I'll just quickly, this is another game which comes to life. Jumanji was made into a film, and the film studio was very eager to make a sequel. And they had some really kind of ideas that I didn't think were very good, like, you know, the Jumanji in the White House, you know, where the rhinos would stampede down the halls of Congress. I thought it was, forgive me, a lame idea. And so I asked the producer, well, what could prevent that from happening? He said, well, I don't know, nothing really, except a better idea. So I said, well, back when they made these old game boards, they often printed a separate game on the back side of the board so you could play two games in one box. I said, what if on the back side of Jumanji there was a space adventure game called Zathura? And instead of just doing the jungle thing again in a different place, we took a house into outer space. And so I wrote up a little treatment for the studio, and they said, we like it. So they made Zathura. I wrote Zathura, and they ultimately optioned it for a film, and it became a pretty good film about a house that goes to outer space. This is about Probudity, and thematically, this is a story. I'm not sure how many people, when they read this, actually get this in the story, but it was inspired by really old fairy tales, and the inspiration were the fairy tales where cleverness triumphs over strength, that the small, weak character is clever and is able to defeat or out-trick, out-fox the large, strong one. In this case, it's just a little sister and her older brother. But her older brother torments her, and she gets the best of him in a very profound and sharp way because she's clever. Yeah, so this is a picture from Probudity. Interested in stretching myself a little bit, so did this book about a non-fiction subject. This is the first person to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. And many people were surprised to find out that this was a woman. And not only that it was a woman, but it was a woman of about 62 years old. Her name was Annie Edson Taylor. And when I started working on this, it was inspired by an article that I'd read 30 years earlier in Sports Illustrated magazine about daredevils of Niagara Falls. And I just wondered, golly, how am I ever going to find out that information? It's so remote. Can I call Time Life and get into the archives? And then it occurred to me I could just Google woman Niagara Falls. You know, up she came. Fortunately, no picture books about Annie. And I wanted to do it because in the same way I thought it was so interesting to be able to tell a story from like the point of view of ants or point of view of Jack Frost, I wanted to get in not only into Annie's point of view, but also get into very strange places. And there are, not here, but there are a couple illustrations in this book which depict Annie inside the barrel as she's going over the falls. And I thought, well, that's a really terrific illustration to actually take a viewer and put them inside a barrel which is plunging over Niagara Falls. And also to try to find some redemption for Annie, because Annie did this, but it brought her none of the fame or fortune that she thought it would bring her. But in my research, I found a quote that was redemptive, that actually gave her story some meaning and was not simply a story of tragedy and failed ambition. Yes, right. There she is getting thrown out of the barrel maker's workshop because she was silly enough to say, I want you to build a barrel so I can go over Niagara Falls. And he refused. But oh, I do have the picture of her inside the barrel here. Okay, so there she is. There she is in the rapids. And there is the barrel. Oh, Lord. And there she is going down, plunging. So anyway, this is my most recent effort, The Misadventures of Sweetie Pie, and it too, sort of in the same way that just things in your house can be inspiration for stories, like the two ants on my countertop. My children lobbied hard for a pet. They thought they were ready to have a pet. They wanted a dog. We didn't want a dog. So my wife and I thought, dog was going to be a little too much. And this is the first thing that makes me feel bad for hamsters, is that hamsters are so often just replacements for something, a pet that the child really wants. Oh, yeah. See, I wanted a dog. I wanted a Shetland pony. You gave me a hamster? A guinea pig? A gerbil? So anyway, that demotes them and disrespects them. And I felt when we went to the pet shop that that process was underway. And I was like the really like, you know, negative daddy. Like, yeah, we don't really want to do this. Well, I'm going to love him so much, daddy. So anyway, we got a hamster. And my children, even though fully prepared in the what it meant to be a hamster caregiver, couldn't get it done. I mean, loved the idea of the hamster, took it home, cuddled it, loved it, but then found other things that were more interesting. And compensated for not taking care of the hamster just by giving it enormous amounts of food. So to prove the hamster that they still loved it, they just gave it tons of food, and the hamster turned into a water balloon, but then is traded off to another owner who just happens to also have a dog, which doesn't work out well for the hamster, but puts the hamster in such an anxious state that it can no longer eat, so it loses some weight. I guess that's good. I don't know. Then the hamster is turned over to yet another child who treats it like a toy. Believes that it's like a little doll and she can dress it up. And, of course, the hamster doesn't like that either. And then she sticks it in a plastic ball and it goes to many places, including a remote part of a little park where the little girl, unable to find it, just gives up and leaves it there. So the hamster is alone for the night, wonders if he's going to live the rest of his life inside that ball, but finds some children the next morning. And one of them is eager to take him home. But her mother is not eager to have the company of a hamster, and because she's done this secretly, when the mother sees the hamster in the house, she's convinced it's a rodent and tries to kill it. But it goes to goes to, it becomes the class pet. The mother says, no, you can't keep it here, but if you want to take it to school, that's okay. So it goes to school, and it lives in school. Now, of course, it hasn't had a lot of attention for a while, but now it gets more than it wants, except during the school day when it sits in its cage and looks out the window, and squirrels come and visit it, and the animal feels so kind of inferior because he's just sitting in the cage, and he's like a toy for children while he sees these squirrels out romping around. And then as the holidays approach, a young boy volunteers to be the caregiver. So I don't know if you've been involved with class pets, but when the holidays come, one kid raises his hand. They usually don't ask their parents first, but one kid raises his hand and says, I want him. So one boy got the pet, Sweetie Pie, got Sweetie Pie to take home. And on his way home, is invited by friends to play some catch, football. And he puts Sweetie Pie down, and he forgets Sweetie Pie. So Sweetie Pie, for the first time, sees snow and feels snow and is finally buried in snow. And there's a point here where Sweetie Pie... All he wants to do is go to sleep. And of course, what I'm describing here is a small furry animal succumbing to hypothermia. He just wants to be still, go to sleep. And for all we know, at this point in the story, he does. Because when the kids get back to the classroom, they discover that there's only an empty cage. The boy who is entrusted with Sweetie Pie tearfully confesses, I forgot him. I ran out during the snowstorm to find him. The cage door was open. He was gone. And of course, all the kids know that he just never latched the cage. And as they say, the hamster... their forgetful classmate probably left the cage unlatched. The hamster had escaped and was now buried under a snowdrift, frozen stiff as a popsicle. Okay, so that's bad news, but the children aren't too upset for long because then one of the kids who got a guinea pig brings that in for as a new class pet. And by the time spring arrived, all the children except for one had forgotten about Sweetie Pie. The boy who'd left him outside could not stop worrying that with the snow melted, the hamster's body would be discovered. So out at recess, the boy's looking under bushes. He can't help himself. He just wants to make sure he sees it first so he can maybe kick some leaves over it. But anyway, he doesn't see it. But here, as we can read in the text, if he looked up high into the trees that surround the school playground, he would have seen two squirrels, one a little smaller than the other without a tail, running through the trees. And they climb into a little nest in this tree. And this is what we learn about those two squirrels, especially the smaller one that was up in the tree. It was not as tasty as the food he'd had when he was younger, but looking out of the nest. With his friends right behind him and the children 30 feet below, with no bars between him and the deep blue sky, Sweetie Pie felt like the luckiest squirrel in the tree. So that's the end. So anyway, while I was working on this story, the obvious kind of story arc for this kind of tale for children is that they present the bad caregivers, and then the hamster is lucky enough to have the sweet child. But it occurred to me, my children were pretty sweet. They played with it fairly frequently, but still, it's a drag, living in a cage with those often stinky wood shavings. So I just simply realized that the best outcome for this story was not to find it in any kind of cage at all, but to find it back out where it belonged with fellow creatures. I did a little research on this. This cross-species friendship would probably not take place, but it is a children's book. And it might. You never know. Anyway, so that's it. So do we have some time for some audience questions? 10 minutes, great. Anybody got one?
I grew up in East Grand Rapids as well and grew up on your stories. I was wondering if there's any illustrations in there that I should go back and take a look at that might have some East Grand Rapids or Michigan roots to them.
Right, okay. Everybody get that? This gentleman grew up in the same little suburb of Grand Rapids, East Grand Rapids, that I did. And I don't think there are any pictures that actually you could look at and say, oh, that I recognize that, except for the street that the Polar Express is stopped on, because that's where it happened. That traditional kind of suburban thing of houses set back about 50 feet and rows of trees on either side of the street, that's the street I grew up on. It's actually Floral Drive, and it looks a lot like that. But I can't remember many other images that I actually drew from my East Grand Rapids childhood.
I was so disappointed you skipped The Sweetest Fig.
Ah.
I love that story.
Thank you.
And when I work in schools, I read that story of All Yours.
Uh-huh.
Because kids can be so conscious of being kind to animals if it's presented in a different way. And that book does it beautifully.
Right. Thank you.
It has a great punch at the end. Well, they love that ending.
Yeah, yeah. So praise for The Sweetest Fig. Thank you very much. Which is a story about a dentist. Apologies to any dentists in the audience, because there might be some typecasting there. I don't know, but the dentist has a little dog. He's unkind to it, but there's a reversal at the end that is the result of the dentist's both cruelty to the dog and cruelty to one of his patients, or at least his distrust of one of his patients. And it creates a terrific reversal at the very end. And the thing I think that satisfies children is that children really love justice. They are keen. They are keen judges of what's not fair and what's unfair. I'm sure any of you who are parents have heard that's not fair a lot. And so this book is actually about justice and revenge, basically. And children do savor the ending quite a bit because the justice is perfect.
Yeah, I love your drawings, you know, initial black and white pencil drawings and like Jumanji. And I see over time you use different media and color and what have you. Would you describe how you evolve and change media?
Right. So I started out, as I pointed out in my earlier comments, that the first one was, that was all I knew how to do. And then the second one, I became more sort of, I think, skillful with those materials. Still black and white, still either Conte, charcoal. These are different kinds of drawing materials that are quite black. They aren't like the graphite pencils most people are familiar with. But then I did Ben's Dream, and I was interested in that because I was just very interested in pen and ink drawing and the way of making different values with little black marks. It just appealed to the kind of, you know, the same fussy craftsman I was when I was six. You know, that using the pen and ink that way appealed to me. But then I did, I think, The Wreck of the Zephyr, and for some reason I imagined it in color. But I didn't have any experience using color materials, but I did sort of know how to draw. So I thought, well, the easiest thing for me to do would be to get a bunch of pastel pencils. So that's basically what The Wreck of the Zephyr is in. And I think just imagining, you know, scenes of boats at sunset, scenes of boats at night, scenes of a boat in a storm, all obviously could have been conveyed in black and white, but for some reason, they just came into my imagination as color. So since then, I've been teaching myself materials. This last book I did in watercolor, which I'd never used before. And I knew what the outcome of that would be. Watercolor, of course, can be used many ways and in the hands of the very skillful, in unpredictable ways. But I knew that the predictable way, especially for the novice, was to create lighter values, more kind of saturated colors. And believing that that was the outcome, I was happy to choose that for The Misadventures of Sweetie Pie, because the story is slightly bleak and has a lesson in it, but I thought it would be like making kind of a Trojan horse if this book that you looked at looked like it was going to be the fun antic playful Disney-like adventures, which are somewhat promised by the palette, by the colors that are there. So I'm using materials partly to just keep myself interested in exploring it, but also anticipating what will serve the story idea and subject matter best.
What did you think of the movie version of the Polar Express?
There are things I liked about it very much. For one thing, for a Christmas story, the Polar Express is the book form, the book version, is fairly melancholy and rather dark. And I mean that even literally in the reproduction. And the book resisted the temptation or the opportunity to make it something more cheerful. And I think it is uplifting, but still it's filled with a kind of melancholy which has to do with a feeling of loss, a loss of believing in something that you believed in when you were a child, or just the loss of believing in the world has the potential to include things like those mythic ideas we have. And so the and this would include, you know, not only the art direction, the score, the music, all had that kind of melancholy quality that I thought was faithful to the book. The problem with it now, and even a little bit when I saw it, was that it was the first generation, in fact, I think the first serious utilization of a brand new technology. And the result was that there's a particular characterization to the kids, which when you looked at it the first time, you were kind of amazed at that it could be done at all, because it was all motion capture. It wasn't conventional animation. I think now that the years have gone by, because the technology has advanced so dramatically, the children look a little odd. But I have to say, I don't think that that's completely out of keeping with the kind of moodiness of the story. But still, I think it's... you know, I have some issues with it about the technology. I also had ideas about expanding the story, making it more complicated and giving more backstory about the conductor. But the filmmakers really felt quite strongly about keeping it confined to the book, pretty simple. We'll expand it a little bit with individual kind of like subplots, but this is the Polar Express and that's it. And when I suggested they could expand it a little bit, they said, "Jesus, Chris, you sound like a producer. What's wrong with you? You know, the writers don't act like that." Nonetheless, it overall satisfied with it, proud of it, proud of the three films that have been made of my books, because often these things can end up being exploitive. They can end up being the work of people who are not seriously committed to making a good film, but I feel that in each one of the films, the filmmakers who took control of the projects were committed, and I think they made good films. Not perhaps the one I would have made, but they made good films.
Which book is your favorite book of all?
All right, so which book is my favorite book of all? I have a really clever answer for that, and I thought if I was ever going to get in Bartlett's, Bartlett's is a book of famous quotations. It would be if somebody actually got that quote down and got it recorded. But then I read the other day that it was actually Frank Lloyd Wright said the same thing about 80 years ago. And they asked him what his favorite building was of all the buildings he'd built. And he said the next one. And so that's always the answer I've given. He went on to expand, just as I have in the past, thinking I was really clever and original, saying, you have to believe that the next thing you're going to do is going to be better than the rest. And because it's going to be better than the rest, it will be your favorite. Because that's what sustains you. That's what makes you want to do another one. And when the next one gets done, the one that I will do after that, that will be my favorite. So my favorite is the next one. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.